are listening to Crime with K. Don't forget to vote this 2020. Make your opinion validated. Make your voice be heard and show your power. Go USA. So today we would be talking about a very different case. Okay, this is case is so difficult. It's just like a roller coaster of emotions. You just gotta sit tight and wrap your head for the story. Okay, this is like, I don't know, you just listen, you be the judge of it. This is just one kind of that story that makes you wonder, like, is this for real? You would question this. You would literally ask this question. You would be like, is this real? Is this the person who did these things? You would really question that. So this is an amazing, crazy, very crazy story. Strap around your belt. We would be diving in right away. So for this story, we are venturing to the land down under. We are talking about Australia. This Australian tale of psychopathy, hatred, revenge, and unthinkable violence is one of the most disturbing and disgusting stories that you would have ever stumbled across. It's almost difficult to believe that such people exist. You know, sometimes you taste or smell something super nauseating and just have to get somebody else to smell or taste it with you because it's so bad. That's kind of why I decided to talk about this story, because you have to really, really, you know, listen to it to believe it, okay? Catherine Mary Knight was thrust into the world and a family filled with chaos on October 5th, 1955 in Moore, New South Wales. From the moment she breathed her first breath, the world seemed to be against her. Kathy was a product of an affair between her mother, Barbara Rogan, and her father, Ken Knight. Rogan already had four sons, and she met Knight through her former husband. The conservative town they lived in was mortified by the affair. I mean, we are talking the times of 50s, okay? This is like mid 50s, and this alleged affair had shocked the whole town because she was having an affair with someone she met through her husband. How ironic. Ken was less of a husband and a father and more of a barbaric heathen. He was a violent alcoholic who raped Barbara multiple times a day and brutally beat the whole family, often with belt. Barbara frequently discussed details of rapes with her children and told them how much she hated both men and sex. Catherine was reportedly sexually assaulted by numerous family members, but not her father until she was 11 years old. I mean, she was in her 11th birthday, or after, furthermore, she was said to be assaulted, and this allegedly has been confirmed by many of her family members. So this is not just a made-up story by an adolescent. These tragedies would help shape her lifelong distrust and disgust with men. With a home life steeped in fear, instability, and complete lack of control over her circumstances, Katie became a notorious school bully who frequently picked on smaller children. She once attacked a schoolmate with a knife, and the teacher who broke up the fight was injured in the process. At the age of 15, Kathy dropped out of school, never having learned how to read or write, and took an unfulfilling job at a clothing store. She was 15 and she never learned to read and write? What kind of school is that? Okay. 1 year later, Kathy landed her dream job. Wow. Kathy had a dream job. Who couldn't learn at 15? Okay, I'm not blaming her. I mean, schooling system sucks at every country, I guess. Working in a slaughterhouse was her dream job. Removing the internal organs of animals was her main job. Wow. Kathy loved chopping up animals and working with knives so much that she hung her first set of butcher knives over her bed. Isn't that crazy? It's like one day you wake up, something, you know, something, you know, there's this minor earthquake and all those knives would come and fall on you and you would be hacked to your death. I don't know, that stuff didn't happen to her. Lucky her. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't we just be paranoid? Anyways, she never knew when she might need them after all. Oh, it was oddly comforting to be able to take one last look at them before she went to sleep. Kathy is wild. It's official. It's hard to have a healthy view of relationships and sex when you have been sexually assaulted multiple times. Your dad rapes your mom, and your mom regularly tells how much she hates the male species, but Kathy still tried to find love. Or maybe she just tried to find an easy target for her fury. You know, you never know how it is. In 1973, Kathy met co-worker David Kellett. They entered into a relationship together and she promptly gained control of the relationship and dominated David in every way. David frequently got into bar fights and Kathy would step in to back her hard drinking boyfriend. She didn't fear bigger, more powerful men. We are Kathy talking over here. Kathy eventually earned herself a reputation for threatening violence anytime anyone displeased her. In 1974, the couple married at Kathy's request. Most likely, the marriage was at her insistence. The couple showed up to the ceremony on a motorcycle and David was drunk. Wow. They are like hipsters in Australia. Just imagine showing up to your wedding on a motorbike and the guy's drunk. That must be a wild story again. Instead of passing along heartfelt advice or guidance or congratulations to her new son-in-law at the wedding, Kathy's mom told him the following words from Kathy's mother herself. She says, "You better watch this one or she'll fucking kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do wrong thing, you're fucked. Don't ever think of playing upon her. She will fucking kill you." Wow. That was some warning, threat, advice, all in all. Right? Barbara added that her daughter has got a screw loose somewhere. I mean, what can I say? I mean, her mother was telling all kinds of wild sort of things to an adolescent kid, and how would she turn up? And they say romance is dead. Kathy and David's wedding night was nothing if not memorable. This is wild. Okay, Kathy tried to strangle David that night because he was only able to have intercourse with her 3 times and fell asleep. Marriage made in hell, of course. Mr. and Mrs. Kellett didn't exactly have what you would call a marriage made in heaven. Kathy was vindictive, jealous, and violent. Somewhere along the way, the couple made the absolute worst decision possible: to have children. Being pregnant did nothing to mellow Kathy. With her bun nearly baked in the oven, Kathy once burned all of David's clothes and shoes and smacked him in the back of the head with a frying pan during an argument. I mean, this is heights of domestic violence over here that we are seeing. So no matter what, if a female or a male is facing a domestic violence in the relationship, I think they should just flee that relationship, take over and go to their own, flee to their own safety first. Okay, so anyways, what did this guy do? In fear for his life, David fled to a neighbor's house where he collapsed from a badly fractured skull. Somehow, Katie, now behaving as a glowing expectant mother, convinced David not to press charges. The couple's daughter, Melissa Ann, was born in 1976. Shortly thereafter, David decided he had enough of his crazy wife. He left Kathy for another woman, and this enraged Kathy. The day after David called it quits, Kathy was spotted pushing Melissa Ann in a baby carriage down Main Street, violently rocking the carriage from side to side, slamming it against the walls and fences. She was admitted to St. Elmo's Hospital, Tamworth, and diagnosed with postpartum depression. I want to know whatever happened to the baby. I mean, she was violently handling a very... It's not even a baby, it's an infant. After spending several weeks in hospital, Katie was released, and it immediately became clear that the stint in psych ward had done nothing to help the deranged new mom. Just a day after being released, Kathy took her two-month-old daughter to some railroad tracks and placed her on the railway line. Then she stole an axe, meandered into the town, and threatened the lives of several people. Poor Melissa, we are talking about the infant, was found and rescued from the railroad tracks by a man in the area known as Old Ted, just minutes before a train passed. Kathy was arrested and sent to St. Elmo's Hospital yet again, but she signed herself out next day. Why don't we just write very bad reviews about St. Elmo's Hospital? I mean, how can she just voluntarily opt out of the treatment when she has she was known assaulting? Maybe he did not launch a complaint, but they might have known that there was history of violence in her relationship. She was neglect of the infant that was in her care, and she gladly hopped out of the hospital. Days later, Katie grabbed her prized knife collection and slashed a woman in the face and demanded that she drive her to Queensland to find David. The woman was able to escape, but before the police arrived, Kathy managed to take a little boy hostage and threatened him with a knife. Police were forced to disarm the raging woman with brooms, and she was admitted to Morissette Psychiatric Hospital. The depth of Kathy's jealousy, vindictiveness, and anger shook the nurses as they listened to their patient tell them how she planned to kill the mechanic who fixed David's car, which allowed David to leave her, then kill David and his mother when they arrived in Queensland. I mean, oh god, even the driver? He's just doing his job. Upon learning the news, David, his mother, and his new girlfriend fled to Aberdeen. Now, either Khalid was still in love with Kathy, or he felt bad for her, or he was too scared to leave her for good. Because when Kathy was released from the hospital, David, along with his mother, moved with Kathy to Woodbridge, a suburb of Brisbane. In March 1980, for reasons No one will ever understand David and Katie had a second child together. Natasha married. 4 years later, Katie left David. She first moved in with her parents and then she rented a house in nearby Muswell Brook. She went back to her slaughterhouse job, but she injured her back the following year and went on disability. She moved out of the rented house and the government provided public housing in Aberdeen. Okay, now she's jobless. She's not able to work. It's not jobless. She's unable to work. She's officially retired as disabled to her job and she's in a public housing. So what happens next? We'll see. In 1986, Katie Knight met her next victim. That's her love interest also. David Saunders was a minor and two fell madly in love during a whirlwind relation courtship. Within months, Saunders moved in with Katie and her two children. However, Katie was furious when Saunders decided to keep his apartment even though he was living with her. She became jealous and suspicious and the couple's relationship soon took nosedive. Katie, never one to suppress her true emotions and evil nature, once got so angry at Saunders that she lit the throat of his 2-month-old dingo puppy right in front of him to show him what she was capable of. Mean she assaulted her first husband, neglected the child, and now she killed a puppy. Where are the team PETA when we need them? This is disgusting. The couple stayed together, however, and welcomed the baby girl later that year. Even after she killed a puppy, she had a kid. That's awesome. Following the birth of Sarah, Saunders put a deposit on a house, which Katie paid off with workers' compensation. In true psychotic fashion, she decorated the family's new abode with animal skins, horns, skulls, rusty animal traps, leather jackets, old boots, machetes, rakes, and pitchforks. Not a single inch of the house was left uncovered. What is that, a house or a trap house? Stunning trap house for those children and her husband. I don't understand. I mean, that is just like outright a Halloween house, not just a house. One day in 1989, Katie got into an argument with Saunders and retaliated by first hitting him in the face with an iron and then stabbing him with a pair of scissors. Saunders moved out, soon returned home, only to find that Katie had cut his clothing into pieces. Months later, he returned again to visit his daughter, but Katie had been granted an apprehended violence order against him. Just great. First she rips his, all his clothes and now he was given an AVO against him. And that too filed by Katie. I just don't know what is happening down there in Australia. 1990s saw Katie become pregnant by a 43-year-old co-worker, John Chillingworth. The following year, she gave birth to a son, Eric. It was one and only romantic relationship Katie would ever have that didn't include any outrageous acts of violence. Or was he muffled to shut his mouth? We will never know. Chillingworth left Katie after 3 years when he discovered that she was having a long-time affair with a man named John Price. Oh, breaking point. Anyways, Kathy's relationship with John Price started out fairly normal. The couple decided to live together in 1995. Price was the father of two older children who lived with him, and they seemed to like Kathy. Price's job was as a miner. Was sufficiently good for some time to keep Kathy comfortable. But Kathy's comfort didn't last long, though. When she asked Price to marry her, he declined, and you can probably guess how Kathy reacted to the rejection. Violence ahead. By the time Price hooked up with Kathy, he was well aware of her reputation. What in the hell was he thinking? Maybe he thought their relationship would be different, or maybe he expected a certain level of abuse, but he never expected that falling in love with Kathy would have consequences that it did. When Kathy didn't convince Price to marry her, she stole money from him and purchased an engagement ring for herself. When Price still refused to marry him, she went after his livelihood. Kathy knew that Price had been stealing expired first aid kits out of the trash at work, so she reported him. First of all, that was trash. That wasn't anyone's property. It was up for disposal. And second of all, it is a first aid kit that was expired. Why was he stealing from trash? And he literally had 17 years of experience on the job, and he was still fired for that. Price kicked Kathy to the curb, but they got back together just few months later. There was a great deal of arguing during this time, and Kathy was determined to make Price's life as miserable as she could. She tried to take control of the house which Price owned, fought with Price's children and even lied and told friends and co-workers that David had molested her daughters. This is horrible. During one particularly heated argument, Kathy stabbed Price. Finally realizing the level of danger he was in, Price filed for restraining order against Kathy on February 29, 2000, but was told the process might take several weeks. That very same day, Price warned friends and co-workers that if he didn't show up for work in the morning, it was because Kathy had killed him. Poor soul. Price knew his girlfriend wanted him dead, but hormones are a powerful thing. On the night of February 29, 2000, the same day Price applied for protective order, Kathy went to his house while he was sleeping. The two had sex, and Price immediately dozed off. Men will be men. Nothing more to elaborate on that. You know how much Kathy likes that. Gripping one of her recently sharpened knives, Kathy plunged the blade into her sleeping partner. Price leapt from the bed and ran out of the house in abject terror. But crazy Kathy overpowered him and stabbed him more than 37 times. Detective Senior Constable Peter Anthony Musico says, "I remember walking down the hallway, and at about shoulder height there were all these blood splatter marks on wall. To me, it's indicative of each attack. He's absolutely fighting for his life. The bloke's just had a blank in the bed when he wakes up. Then stab, stab, stab. He's getting up. There is arterial spurting on the rope and the bed and on the doorway. There's a bloodied handprint or swipe on the western side of the door near the dressing table, and the blood around the light switch. It looks like he's tried to turn the light switch on, and then all down the hallway there are bloody handprints everywhere." and he's almost made it. He's opened the front door. The screen door is shut. There is blood staining trajectory again, flicking out across the front door. He's almost made it, but he wouldn't have survived. He would have been absolutely horrified, terrified, probably terrified more than horrified, trying to get out and all the time being stabbed. The scene would be something like he is bleeding from everywhere, every wound, and he's limping for his life while Katie is behind him trying to butcher him and coming behind him. It's just like a scene out of a slasher movie. So but then when Katie started stabbing Price, she was just getting started. She was about to become one of the most notorious killers in Australian history and the most notorious female killer in the country. Katie was skilled at butchering animals, and Price's lifeless body was about to become her next project. First, she skinned Price and hung the skin from a hook in the living room. He was skinned post-mortem. Thank God for small favors. Then she decapitated him and tossed it into a pot and cooked it with some vegetables. Katie cooked several other parts of Price's body, including his buttlocks, and served them as a steak along with the vegetables, a baked potato, and gravy. She planned to serve the meals to Price's children and placed the food on two separate plates on a table along with handwritten spiteful notes. And what was she trying to do? Recreate the mad tea party? And she is the twisted allies in twisted wonderland. I'm just short for words, but she wasn't quite finished yet. After setting out place cards for Price's children, she positioned the rest of Price's skinned body on his favorite chair, crossing his legs. Although Katie slaughtered and cooked her husband, she didn't eat any of him herself. Sensing how much trouble she was in, Katie instead opted to take a handful of pills in an attempt to kill herself. She laid down beside the headless skinned corpse of her lover and passed out, but didn't die. Fortunately for the oldest Price children, they never had the chance to dine on their dad. They had been gone the previous night and hadn't yet returned. When a neighbor noticed that Price's car was still in the driveway and he hadn't gone to work, the neighbor knocked on his door to check on him. No one answered, and the neighbor noticed there was blood on the doorknob. She immediately phoned the police. One nosy neighbor. But for good nosy neighbor. When Katie came to, she claimed to have no memory of the crime. She deserves an Oscar for this. She was to stand trial in October 2001, but suddenly changed her plea to guilty and was sentenced to life in prison, the first Australian woman ever to receive life sentence. Cannibal Catherine Knight's reign of terror was over. Now in her early 60s, she is currently serving her sentence at Silverwater Women's Correctional Center. So that's about her horror story. Now we will deep dive into her psychological aspects. I mean, this is not a simple kind of crime. What was going on in Katie's head? When Katie was facing trial, she was interviewed by three psychiatrists to determine her sanity. The doctors all agreed that Katie was sane and knew what she was doing on the night of Price's murder, but they diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, shortly known as BPD. BPD is considered a serious mental illness that centers on inability to manage one's emotions effectively, according to National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. The disorder can be caused by any number of things, including emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, loss, neglect, and bullying, which were all present in Kathy's life. Some of people may be more likely to develop BPD due to their biological genetic makeup, and harmful childhood experience can increase the risk. Due to intense internal emotional conflict, someone with BPD might take unnecessary risks, like have intense mood swings, suffer severe bouts of anger, depression, or anxiety. They may have difficulty managing daily tasks at home, performing at work, and maintaining relationships, which is very true, especially when it comes to maintaining relationships. Anxiety, depression, eating disorders, and suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts often accompany BPD as well as substance abuse. In the past, it was believed that BPD was nearly impossible to treat. Today, we know that's not true. While it can be difficult to treat, an individual who sincerely wants to get better can have great success in doing so with the help of therapy and medication, because without our willpower, without telling that we are facing a problem, any kind of treatment will have no effect on our body. So, a study published in 2016 found that, according to measures in the study, BPD is moderately or strongly associated with a range of criminal behaviors among psychiatric inpatients, likely owing to these individuals' extreme proclivity towards disinhibition and poor emotional regulation. This is, however, only one study, and a fairly small one at that. While it may be true that there are a high percentage of BPD and other mental health disorders in prison population, only 3-5% of violent acts can be attributed to people with a serious mental illness. In fact, people with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of violent crime compared to the rest of population. In other words, BPD might help explain Catherine Knight's extremely violent behavior, but it is extremely rare that BPD causes someone to do such evil things. It certainly was not the only contributing factor to her violent outburst. Still, it's clear that Kathy probably had a combination of genetic factors and tragic childhood experience working against her. What many people don't know is that Kathy was a twin. What? She was a twin? She had a twin who didn't take the same psychotic path in life. Why one sibling can wind up so deeply mentally disturbed while another one leads a comparatively normal life is still a mystery, and that is why twin studies during Nazi times were so popular among those crazy scientists. Anyways, just imagine a place and universe where one crazy scientist who's crazy about twin births and he gets to study Kathy kind of person, and I'm just curious how it would turn out, how weird it would be, right? It would be just batshit crazy. It would be a very good Hollywood movie. Kathy Knight starts her day bright and early in her prison. By 8 a.m., she's at work in prison's factory making headphones. It's a noisy job, but it's one she relishes in. She's one of the best workers and commands the highest wages. Victoria Shembri is a former penthouse pet model who became Knight's prison confidant. She explained, "She gets through more work than anyone. She enjoys her job and takes pride in what she does. Four guards flank her. They watch her every move and are with her every day." One thing has to be appreciated, even though Katie had some emotional, extremely emotional, uncontrollable behaviors which led to murderous rage, she was a very prompt worker who loved her job. That was one thing. Katie's shift ends at 1 p.m. and she promptly goes to lunch. Then she retires to her cell, which consists of a bed, clothes, and a large table that she uses for art and writing letters. This is a thing, okay? You can talk to any surviving serial killers, murderers. You can just write them, and if you are lucky enough, they would write you back. The one of the precautions that is usually mentioned is that, you know, you maintain a separate PO box, not reveal your home address to such killers and things like that. So that's a real thing. So Shembri also describes Katie as hoarder. She says her room is very cluttered. She had shit everywhere. She had been there for a long time. It was like she'd kept everything she'd ever been given, and she never disposed of things, is what, in one word. Katie spends her free time crocheting, knitting, and painting. She even does pottery. While she donates much of her work to raise money for charity and the jail, she never signs her work because, according to Shembri, she doesn't want some sick person buying her art because they think what she did was cool. The thought of someone hanging something on their wall just because she's a killer repulses her. I mean, this is amazing, right? She's out of her denial. She's realizing that her acts were inhuman, not very good, and she is repenting her actions. Yeah, she's repenting her actions. That's a great change. She's a human somewhere inside. Moving on. But Shembri claims she has never seen her use the phone. Unsurprisingly, all of her family and friends on the outside have abandoned her. Inside the walls of the correctional facility, Katie is known as Nana, a kind, gentle soul who often mentors the younger inmates. She's known as a peacemaker who breaks up arguments and prevents them from escalating. She has never misbehaved in the prison, though she has no problem telling people off, including the prison guards when they search her cell. Despite her caring nature in prison, the other inmates know better than to challenge her. They simply do not fuck around with her. According to a correctional officer familiar with Katie, Catherine Mary Knight was a miserable woman who had miserable upbringing, and she took out her rage on the people she was supposed to love the most. She was terrified of being alone and terrified of losing control. But she was also a sane woman who knew what she was doing. Her comments regarding not signing her artwork suggest she knew it was wrong, but that doesn't mean she has empathy, but she does regret, is what I think. Some people are evil, okay? Some people are evil, but not everyone is born evil. They're just finding themselves in that kind of situations and that kind of places. But Katie turned out to be such a glaring example of evil, whereas she had a twin who was under the same roof, facing the same circumstances, and things are there, but she reacted Kathy's twin reacting to her problems was very much different than how Kathy was reacting to her problems. Half of the problems that we face in our life are on and only because of our reactions. Because how we react, 90% of the time it is our reaction that would glaringly make the problem a big thing or a small thing, right? So that's about our roller coaster ride about Catherine, cannibal Catherine. That's a tragic story of people in her life, tragedy of her life, and one thing is that she regrets her actions. That's one thing that, you know, there is repent in her life, and she feels that. But then, so ending this episode with one last advice is that when you are going for a date, or you know, you're talking to someone whom you want to share your life with, ask about them, their childhood first, and then asking what their favorite dish is, or where they would like to hang out, you know, rather than that, know about their childhood, because you know, you that way you can have less chances of popping up as a story in the next episode of the podcast. With that, I would be signing off. Always listen to Crime with Kay.